Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat. You haven't been watching the cricket, have you?
No, I don't like cricket.
You don't like cricket. As the song goes, I don't like cricket. I love it.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, Dreadlock Holiday. That's a good song.
Yeah. No, it's actually getting interesting.
Finally. I don't believe you. It's cricket.
It's finally actually interesting. Look, I'm not a diehard cricket fan, but what I have noticed particularly of late is when you're watching the tests, every half hour you're watching it, it's a different team can be in a position of winning. Like you can't pick the result.
Right.
Like at one moment, one team might seem like they're a world ahead, and then half hour later, something happens, and all of a sudden, it's almost like the exact opposite. And yeah, I mean, it's just been interesting. At the moment, Australia is pretty up in this test, so not likely England will win, but it's either going to be a no result or Australia will win.
What's a no result?
So the way I think about it, right, cricket's pretty much the only sport that can differentiate between a tie and a draw.
Right, okay.
Right, they're two different concepts. A tie being both teams score exactly the same runs, right? You get the exact same number of runs, so it's a tie at the end of the day.
Right.
A draw or a no result would be, right, each team needs to bat out two innings. So for argument's sake, if the first team that they bat first, they might bat two innings, but the second team may run out of time to complete their second innings before getting more runs than that first team.
Right.
So basically they've run out of time. Either the first team didn't get them out, didn't bowl them out, or they didn't get their runs.
Right.
So it's no result. It's just a draw. So after 5 days, it comes down to a draw.
5 days. Riveting stuff.
Yeah. I can tell you're riveted.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, over the course of the 5 days, things don't move quick, but when they do, like I said, they're big shifts in who's actually in front.
Yeah. Things don't move quick. Yeah. That sounds like cricket.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know if you heard, but the biggest talking point from the Boxing Day test down in Melbourne was the length of the grass on the pitch.
Right.
Yeah.
Riveting stuff.
Oh, it was. It was 10 mil, and apparently that's too long.
Yeah.
And the game only lasted 2 days.
Right.
Because the pitch was 10 mil.
I used to work with a guy called Rob Langley. He's a network engineer. And I remember, it must be 10, 15 years ago, we were talking about cricket. And I was saying to him, you know, I have tried to watch it. I just don't have the attention span. I just, like, if things aren't happening, I'm just bored. And, you know, it's... Anyway, he was explaining to me that he's like, oh, yeah, like, you know, you don't go to the cricket for the cricket. It's like you go to the cricket and, you know, and like... By the time you get to like 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's like 1 a.m. outside of, you know, a nightclub in Sydney. Like everyone's just smashed and.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is that too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, gosh. And I guess if you're not watching the cricket, you've been keeping yourself busy?
No. I've just been relaxing, you know, not doing much, putting my feet up, enjoying the holidays. Yeah. Yeah. No. That's obviously not true. Yeah, no, I've been keeping myself very busy. Looking forward to the next holiday. Don't know when that's going to be, but looking forward to having some time off work and actually not working, which would be good.
Yep.
I've been
going away, and I've been told I'm not taking the laptop.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So
next time I go away, I probably will be taking a laptop because I might be going to London at the start of next month to speak at the Maui Day.
Oh, shit.
Mm.
Sweet.
So I'll need my laptop for that one.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's not confirmed yet, so we can't put that in.
Yeah, yeah.
But which is annoying because actually by the time this episode comes out, it will definitely be confirmed one way or another.
By the time this episode, look, you can leave the edit for a couple of weeks. You don't have to edit it just now.
That's true. Yeah.
You got a couple, you got at least 4 weeks. You can release it on the plane on your way to London.
Yeah, that's probably what will happen. Yeah, man, today is hot, huh?
Yes, and the weekend is only going to get hotter.
Yep. Yeah, we'll be doing swimming lessons this week in the pool out back.
Yep.
which has been good. It's been, Riley loves it. Sadie hates it.
I don't want to compare Sadie to our dog, but our dog hates the water. Or doesn't hate it, but doesn't like the water.
Oh, really?
But when it's hot outside and you can just tell she is not happy,
yeah,
we throw her in the pool.
Right.
And just, you know, we can keep her calm and just really help cool her down.
Yeah. 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 I expect she appreciates that even if she doesn't think she's going to beforehand.
Yeah. Yes. So,
but yes, busy, 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 and back at work now, of course.
Yes.
And you're back at work as well?
For the week, and then we're off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Actually, by the time this is out, we're back, I think. Actually, yeah, by the time this one gets released, we're back.
Yeah.
So we're off, we're back. Yeah.
We're just relay.
Sorry?
We're just relay.
Yeah.
Take turns leaving the country.
That's it. Just before we hit record, or technically just after we hit record, but before the edits, we would... having a quick discussion around your current experiences with Azure's AI Foundry.
Yep. Yep.
Right. And I guess how the current experience with the tooling does not live up to, I guess, what has been sold.
Doesn't quite live up to the hype, yeah.
To the hype. And that kind of, it's not the first time that you or I have mentioned it. We haven't really dug into this in the past too much. But it has come up as a bit of an undertone to a few conversations, particularly in the past.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking back to two episodes ago now, you mentioned Aspire.
Yeah.
And I think, and yeah, particularly myself too, not really, I guess when you're swinging those tools in anger, they just don't seem to be hitting the mark.
Yeah. And I think what I've learned is that you've got to understand who these things are for and what they're targeting, what they actually do, right? And the answer to those two questions is not me and not what I need.
Yep.
So what I found, I mean, and you know, the thing is, anything that is the new hot thing and anything that there's buzz around and hype around, that messaging doesn't come through clearly ever. It's always like, look at this awesome new thing. This is cool. Look at everything we're doing with it. These are all the problems that it solves. And they don't go into detail on those problems. The problems are very high level, and therefore it's like astrology, right? It appeals to everyone. Yeah. So I have, look, not extensive experience with Aspire. I have a fair bit of experience. I have found it to be, when I first started playing with it, I found it to be very good. I found there was a lot of rough edges and a lot of polish that it needed. Mm-hmm. I was very forgiving of that because it was new. You know, and I tend to be forgiving of these things. And, you know, there used to be a rule that anything that Microsoft release, you don't touch in production until version 3.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking .NET. .NET 2 had a good time.
Yeah.
.NET 1, definitely not. .NET 2 was all right.
Yeah. But .NET 3, .NET Framework 3,
yeah,
was where it really kind of came into its own. And with .NET Core as well, like .NET Core 2.1.
Yes.
Was pretty stable, right?
Yeah.
But .NET Core 3 was where it really kind of hit its stride.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Xamarin Forms, I've said, like Xamarin Forms 3.5 really was the version. Windows XP, famously, Service Pack 2 was when it, you know, it was really kind of, well, I mean, obviously Service Pack 2 addressed some very serious problems. That's a whole other story.
I know. Did you hear that talk from Richard Campbell about that? The history of Windows?
No.
Was really good. But in summary, basically, the reason why XP Service Pack 2 came out as it did, when it should have been a whole new OS, was basically that Microsoft couldn't afford people not to upgrade.
Yeah.
Because there were so many security holes in XP. Yeah. So rather than releasing a brand new OS, they said, here's a service pack, when it should have actually been a whole new operating system.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, that's why I said it addressed some very serious problems. Same thing with, so you used to get Windows Server versions and Windows Desktop versions in lockstep.
Yeah.
So the Windows XP Server version was Windows Server 2003. And when they released Service Pack 2, there was Windows Server 2003 R2. And that, you know, that was based on the new kernel and had all the same fixes, but also had a bunch of new features, particularly around AD and some other stuff as well. So anyway, it, like, the version 3 rule is not without exceptions. But generally, I find with Microsoft, it tends to be Windows itself, right? So Windows 3 or Windows 3.1 was really the version that you didn't want to be using it before then.
Yeah, definitely. Did anyone use it before then?
Some people did. Some folks at Apple did. I actually just finished listening to that podcast you recommended, Acquired.
The Microsoft one? The Microsoft, was it a three-part series with each part being about 3 hours each?
I thought it was just two parts, actually.
Oh, maybe it's two.
And the first one is like 3 hours and the second one is over 4 hours.
Yeah.
So really good long form, like well-researched, in-depth stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And as a treat, follow that one up with the interview they did with Steve Ballmer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Keen. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's really interesting, actually. I mean, I've studied the history of Microsoft a little bit, and really interesting to kind of learn that much more about it and that much depth. Like I've only superficially looked into it before.
Yeah.
Because I found it interesting. And this is like a real, real, real good insight. And yeah, definitely the Steve Ballmer interview sounds like a treat.
It still blows my mind, completely off topic. But in that interview, he actually, like he mentions, he is now Microsoft's largest single shareholder.
Right? It has been for a long time, yeah.
And he has been for a while. And he gets basically all the money he receives in dividends, it goes out to his philanthropic causes, right?
Yeah.
But interestingly, he was saying he cannot afford to sell his shares.
No, of course not.
The capital gains tax alone for those shares would destroy him.
Yeah.
So basically, he's in this situation where he has to retain them.
Yeah.
And take those dividends.
I mean, think how many people he would bankrupt if he sold them as well.
Yeah.
Because if he sold all his shares, what would that do to the value?
Yeah, exactly. And but that's his, like, that he's saying, like, I don't have any intention to sell them, but I can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's just, anyway, complete aside. No, an awesome episode, really good, and completely changed my opinion, my thoughts around him.
Yes. Same. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly didn't know as much about him before as I did after. And yeah, I had a decent amount of respect for him, I think, before listening to that, but I have a lot more now.
Yep. Sorry, back on topic.
Yeah. So version 3.
Yep.
If it's before version 3, you're taking a risk touching it in production. Now, if you think about our last episode, nobody does that anymore in anything in tech. Like now it's whatever the latest thing is, use it. And if it's broken, throw away what you build and build something else tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's the mentality, right?
Yep.
Now, if you think about Microsoft specifically and you think about the tools and the developer tooling and the products that Microsoft make, Microsoft are positioned as, no, we're not that. Like, you know, you've got everyone else doing their quote unquote move fast and break things. Although I did love that quote from AdaConf, move fast and build things. I can't remember who said that. Was that Donna?
I can't remember now.
Yeah. I wrote it down. You know, look, that was good. But yeah, like that's the mentality. It's like break things, break things, break things, break it.
Yeah.
Build something shit, throw it away, move on to the next thing. We're not here for a long time. We're here for a good time. Do you know what I mean?
Sounds like a topic that we've covered quite a lot.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah. And it's more or less exactly what we spoke about last time on the episode that came out today.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
In fact, between the episode that came out today and the episode that's coming out 2 weeks today, it's a topic we've pretty much covered in both.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Interestingly, that reminded me, did you see, I tagged you on in a post from David Fowler the other day on LinkedIn?
No. Oh, shit. I've got
LinkedIn. It was interesting because this was 2 days ago. This was Monday and he posted something that was basically more or less a synopsis of the topic that we discussed that we released today. And I'm going to elaborate on that a bit today and what we're talking about as well.
Yep. Okay. I'm just trying to bring it up. See if I can find that tag. No, it's not coming up easily.
No?
No.
Okay. Basically, he was talking about something. What's he talking about? AI. And he was talking about his... Sorry, my brain just switched off for a second.
That's right. Mine still hasn't switched back on.
Yeah. He was talking about his development process and how he's using AI and how he's rapidly iterating, and he's got teams of agents, some running locally, some in GitHub, and they're just building things and doing PRs and like rapidly iterating and building features and products, and it's amazing. He was like, this doesn't scale at all to teams. This is an individual workflow and it's awesome for that, but this is not something that scales for teams at all. And that's basically what we said in our episode that we released today. And that's what we're talking about. It's like, you know, it's a really great team for individual, a really great tool. AI in general is a great tool for individuals. But obviously it is the new hotness. So every enterprise, every business is trying to capitalize on it. And again, like that kind of pretty much taps right back into something we spoke about a few episodes ago, which was the specialist myth. It's like, it's the newest thing of that. It's like the nerds have, you know, nerded out and put together this awesome new technology, right? It's basically a new class of algorithms or models, as we call them, based on multidimensional math proximity calculations, right? I mean, that's really what it is. It's so nerdy, it's ridiculous. And it's cool. And like, you know, these nerds have had a fucking awesome time, like just having fun and building something cool and saying, wow, look at this, and doing amazing things with it. And then the suits have come along and said, yeah, but we need to turn this into something that makes shitloads of money, right?
Yeah.
And yeah,
well, it costs a shitload of money to run it too, don't forget.
It did. It doesn't so much anymore. But, well, I mean, this is the thing, is the rest of the public is paying for it. I'm not sure if you've been following what's been going on with RAM.
RAM? Ah, the global shortage.
Yeah. The price of RAM is skyrocketed through the roof. So I bought a new laptop 4 weeks ago, something like that.
Yeah.
And I normally don't do the RAM upgrade. So I always buy something that's user upgradable, like always. But I normally don't do the vendor supplied RAM upgrade because it's expensive.
Yep.
And I normally just go and buy my RAM. And I wanted to upgrade this to 64 gig because I run VMs and I run all kinds of other things and so on and so forth. So I went and shopped around for a couple of sticks of RAM for like what I was thinking I would pay, I don't know, a couple of $100 for or something. It's like $600-$700. And I'm like, fucking hell, you're joking. Yeah. So now it's not just like GPUs, now it's RAM and CPUs as well and SSDs as well. And the annoying thing is they're all just buying it up. They're not even doing anything with it. Like if there was this interview with Satya Nadella where he says, my problem right now is that I haven't got enough power to run my data centers.
Yeah.
He's like, it's not a chip shortage. I've got the chips. They're just sitting there not doing anything. And that's pissed a lot of people off. Because it's like, well, can you fucking not hoard them, please?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. If you look at, do you know who Jensen Huang is?
Yeah. NVIDIA CEO.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, obviously he has pissed off everyone because NVIDIA obviously started out as a gaming company. Like they built graphics cards. And he doesn't want to make products for gamers anymore. He wants to completely exit the gaming market. Yeah. Obviously he's the CEO of NVIDIA, right? So he has been a successful individual running a successful company for a long time. But then of course, when Bitcoin came along and the prices of GPUs skyrocketed, he already had his exit strategy. Well, maybe not strategy, but he wanted to exit the gaming market then. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously LLMs have come along and, you know, they really obviously don't need the GPUs, but they work much better on the GPUs. And, you know, he's said multiple times he doesn't want to be a gaming company anymore. He doesn't want to sell gaming graphics cards. He wants to sell enterprise GPUs to enterprise customers because they're the ones that pay him more money reliably.
Yeah, of course. And then not just pay more money reliably, but they have big order books.
Yeah.
And consistent order books.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a whole other topic, right? Maybe it was you that was telling me this, or maybe this was something else. But basically, what happens is all of the tech companies essentially just shuffle money around to each other.
Oh, there's been, I don't know if I said it, but there's a meme going around about that, right?
Is there?
Yeah. What was it like? Microsoft invests $10 billion in OpenAI. OpenAI invests $10 billion in NVIDIA. NVIDIA invests the $10 billion in somewhere else. And it just all, just big circle.
Big circle jerk.
Yeah. I wasn't going to say it.
Yeah. I said it. Yeah.
It's all creative accounting, right?
Yeah. Anyway, we're still off topic here, right? So the point is AI, right? Surely we have AI fatigue. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when we started this podcast, we said we weren't going to talk about AI because we already had AI fatigue back then.
Yes.
Now, of course, and, you know, the frustrating thing about that is that I think, as we established on the last episode, both of us actually really like it. It's a really valuable tool for us as individuals. It's the shoving it down the throat of everyone and everything that's getting a bit tiresome. So
it's almost at the point of slapping a Y2K compliance sticker on your toaster.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So back to the point, right? So nerds built this thing. Everyone's nerding out. And this is like such an echo of what we were talking about in the Specialist Myth episode. But people are getting rich. Like, people are making money.
Yeah.
And the big players, they're not trying to stop it, but they don't want to miss out. So the people that are doing well with AI at the moment, the early adopters are people that didn't build with guardrails or enterprise, you know, constraints or patterns. And some of them have emerged into very robust companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what goes on under the hood, and I don't think I want to, but they're not enterprise. You know, there aren't enterprise companies that have entered the market as a large enterprise and says, here's our new enterprise product that's a new product category, and everyone's, you know, bought it from there. I'm trying to think of a good example of when that's happened in the past. I don't know, like Azure, like cloud in general. Like cloud didn't emerge from disruptors. Cloud enabled disruptors. Cloud emerged from the big players,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This wasn't that. This was disruptors. And it's come along, and now the big boys want a slice of the pie. But the thing is it's not a mature technology. It's at least from the enterprise side. So where I'm going with this is, obviously Microsoft, they're not going to be left behind. They are building AI tooling. They've got a lot of exceptional stuff. And I tell you, the most interesting things that Microsoft ever do come out of their research. In fact, yeah, a lot of very, very interesting research comes out of Microsoft, like public, you know, public research contributing to the global body of knowledge that's not part of, you know, it obviously feeds into their, you know, the R&D that they contribute feeds into their commercial work. But Microsoft do contribute a lot of genuine research, and not just in tech. And some of the stuff that they're doing around AI is incredible as well. Like Trellis, obviously I have an interest in game dev, so I'm really interested in Trellis, Vibe Voice, you know, Microsoft are doing some amazing stuff in AI. But on the enterprise side, Microsoft's enterprise play has always historically been Windows desktop and Windows Server. Now it's Azure and Microsoft 365, right?
Yep.
So obviously there's a lot of AI tooling in Azure, and Microsoft's big AI play in Azure now, it was Azure OpenAI. So it used to be, obviously, they bought a big stake in OpenAI, wrapped it in Azure, and you were just using OpenAI, but via Azure, right? So the Azure OpenAI client is literally a wrapper for OpenAI that just handles some of the Azure-specific stuff like auth and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
But otherwise, it works under the hood exactly the same way as OpenAI. And that is stable and mature. It's been around for a few years now and works well, right? The Foundry stuff doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And like, here's the thing. If you think about Microsoft's bread and butter and their customer base and the enterprise, it's us. It's .NET devs, right? You know, mm-hmm. The enterprise world was built on .NET, right? But none of the .NET stuff works reliably. So if you want to play in the AI space, you've got to use Python, because it's all Python first. The Python stuff works, right? A lot better than... Well, let me put it this way. If you read some docs on Microsoft about what you can do with Foundry, the Python docs will, you know, even though it says preview, by and large, the Python SDK and the Python samples will do what the docs say they do.
Yep.
The .NET ones don't. That's the first thing. The second thing, the patterns. So Foundry, in fact, let me take a step back. You've probably heard the term MCP. Model Context Protocol. So MCP is the big thing, or has been over the past year. If this is how we enable LLMs to talk to our system, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that you have to remember about MCP, and this is, again, the thing that people don't tell you, is MCP is designed as an open, discoverable protocol, right? So if you have, and again, it's really geared towards like STDIO. So it runs like in memory on your local machine. It is supported over HTTP as well. Doesn't work. Like, it works, but not reliably or consistently, and everyone implements it in a different way. which kind of undermines the whole point of a protocol, right? And even then, like, auth is completely non-standard. The only way I have reliably been able to get MCP to work in an enterprise context is to basically tell my LLM to include some kind of authentication, like a token in the payload, and deserialize that and validate it in middleware myself, like using like pre-existing token validation, either at the infrastructure layer or using existing middleware or tooling, has just not worked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because MCP doesn't work reliably in that way. But here's the thing, right? You don't need it. Like, if you use the OpenAI tooling, there's a way of doing tool calling built into that that's been there since day one. And that works very reliably. It doesn't rely on any of that stuff because you're not exposing it externally. But that's not the big sexy new thing. So that's not what's getting pushed. And the other thing, if you think about the way that Foundry works and the way that it's geared towards, and the multi-agent workflow doesn't work, right? And that's like one of the main things that doesn't work, like, at all, right? And, you know, the way that it's supposed to be not no code, but low code. And, you know, you've got a portal and you can build and train and publish agents and all that. Like, everyone's crawling all over themselves to launch this agent marketplace. And that's just not going to work the way that people want it to work, I don't think. But we'll see. But yeah, it's just not reliable and doesn't work. But what it's really there for, what Microsoft really want to do is they've already made their AI play, and that's Copilot.
Yeah.
Right? So everything that works well in Foundry only works well with the Copilot API, which is an additional $60 per user per month license on top of your M365 license. And that's where their effort is going. Now, again, nothing wrong with it. Like, that bit works well. And that's fine. Like, that's what they're building. The problem is, and in fairness, like, it's my fault. I'm reading into it and I'm seeing things that are not there and I'm inferring things that they're not saying. So it is down to me, but that's not what I'm building. And that's not what my customers are building.
Mm.
And therefore, like, all of this new tooling and this new Foundry stuff is not for me and it's not for my customers. And, like, that's okay. It's just that, and maybe this is my fault for getting caught up in the hype train. Maybe it's Microsoft's fault and everyone else's fault for not adequately tempering the hype train or not adequately explaining what these things are, what they do and who they're for. Now, I want to give you another example I'm not going to give you an example. You brought it up. So I'm going to elaborate this on another one. And that one is Aspire, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So getting back to Aspire, like, I quite like Aspire. I just have to constantly remind myself what it's for and what it's not for. So I started playing with it a year and a half ago or something like that. And I liked it. It was a bit rough around the edges and I thought it was cool. I wasn't using it in anger. About a year ago, just over a year ago, I used it on a client project and it worked pretty well. But again, yep, the scope was quite limited. Over the past 12 months, I've been using it more and more on client projects and on my own projects. And it works when it works and it works well. But I've come to realize there are a lot of things I don't like about it. And I've also come to realize that the reason I don't like those things is because I'm not trying to use it for what it's meant for.
I sense a common theme.
That's the common theme. That's the thread here. Yeah. So here's what I saw as the promise of Aspire and what it's not, right? I thought this is a way of building your cloud application locally using local tooling, running it, getting all the different components working, and then being able to deploy that based on what you've got locally. Now, that is actually true, but the reality is it's effective or most effective for a very specific subset of those use cases. So the thing that is frustrating for me about working with Azure, because again, I like Azure, right? But the thing that is frustrating for me for it is, if you think back to what we've said about .NET and C# a lot, about it being about the pit of success, yep, Azure is not geared towards the pit of success. Doing everything the right way is the hardest way of doing things.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah.
The cynic in me there kind of sits there and says, well, that's because if you do things the right way, that's also going to be cheaper. If you do things the wrong way and you misconfigure things and you're spinning up services you don't need, look, your bill goes, all of a sudden your bill's gone from $10 a month to $10,000 a month.
On the one hand, you could be right. On the other hand, maybe it's an escape hatch as well. Like, this is now I'm getting cynical as well. As I say, it's that can't possibly, because you know, it's worse for Microsoft if you next finish something and it's not robust and secure and you get a breach, and it's like Azure breached, you know. But then, of course, it's an escape hatch because they can say, oh, you didn't do it properly. But it's like, well,
like I said, look, I don't believe that. But like I said, there's a cynic that's kind of,
Look, I'm just being silly, right? But like, here's the thing. I'll give you an example, right? Managed identity. Mm-hmm. Managed identity is the right way of doing things, right?
Yes.
So if you want to have a SQL database on Azure, you don't want a connection string with a password in it. And in fact, you shouldn't have been doing that with your servers on-premise either, right? You should have been using a managed service account and just having your application pool identity have permissions to the database. So that hasn't really changed, right? Yeah. What has changed is that a database on Azure is a managed platform as a service provided feature, not a database that you're managing. Therefore, let me just cut to the chase, right? If you want to set up a managed identity on Azure to access a SQL database, you can't do that through the portal.
Okay.
Let me say that again, because I want to be very clear.
Yeah.
You cannot set up a managed identity to have access to a SQL database via the portal. You have to go into that SQL database and execute SQL code to add that identity as a user in the database. I know that doesn't sound like a big deal, but this is a cloud service where the easiest possible thing to do should be doing it the right way.
Yeah. Okay? Especially when it comes to security and access.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not. And I'll give you another example. Azure Verified Modules.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't there a one-click deploy from catalog Azure Verified Modules in the portal? Because that is, again, the quote, right way of doing it. So why is that not the easiest way of doing it?
Yeah.
Right? Azure Container Apps. I've been playing with Azure Container Apps over the past few weeks. I mean, look, I've been playing with them for a few years, but in anger over the past couple of weeks and just facing problems that I haven't really faced before. And I sat down and I asked myself the question, why am I not just using a web app or what used to be called app service?
Yeah, yeah.
And there is no good answer to that question. I should be. For what I'm building, I should just be using a web app. And this is what I mean by the problem is me. It's like, you know, the talk is, the hype is, use container apps. They're more flexible, blah, 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 blah. Sure, true. But it's not what I need, not what I want. And that's not, granted, like a lot of the projects I've worked on, they've been the right thing. But for what I'm doing now, it's like, and again, this is a me problem. Like, I've got it into my head that that is the right thing. So that's just now my default, and it's the wrong default. And that's what you get when you use Aspire. And I'll come back to that. So container apps, I won't go off on a rant about container apps. Like, I've got a few issues with them, but maybe we won't go into that right now. But yeah, I've just been having some problems with those that I shouldn't have had because I shouldn't have been using them. And so, yeah, so back to the Aspire thing. Like, if you use Aspire deploys container apps. The first time, so again, like, this was all very new and it was all very preview, but the first time I tried to use Aspire to build something locally and deploy it to Azure, it deployed everything as Azure container apps containers, including the Aspire dashboard. Which there is a niceness about that, particularly the open telemetry and the tracing, sure. But the Aspire dashboard, the UI, the API, all of the databases, everything else, despite the fact that these things are Azure native features, it just bundled them as containers and ran them. My biggest complaint about Aspire is not about Aspire at all. It's about the Cosmos DB emulator. That just shouldn't exist because it doesn't work. It's so unreliable that it shouldn't exist in my mind. That's a whole other, thing.
No, well, but that is, I guess, the point of the conversation, right?
Yeah.
Basically being sold a promise, a dream.
Yeah.
And then taking the car for a spin and realizing that it's not what you paid for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You've been promised a dream of the Cosmos emulator actually being able to emulate Cosmos,
yeah,
but clearly it's falling down somewhere, and it's not.
It just doesn't work. Like it exposes a very, very minimal amount of emulated Cosmos functionality. But what they should do is what they do with SQL: just package the thing as a container and let you run it locally. Like, why won't they just do that? The reason they won't is because it's an Azure native product that is so deeply integrated with everything else in the infrastructure that they probably can't, right? Yeah. But then that's a whole other thing as well. And going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, having to run these things multiple times, there's no way of testing your deployments without actually deploying them. Like, even if you do, I've had what ifs that pass, and then of course it fails on deployment. There should be, in my view, a testable surface area for Azure where you can say, is this going to work? It doesn't have to do everything and provide all the functionality, but it should provide the surface area so you can validate your deployments. Anyway, that again is another topic. Just getting back to Aspire. So Aspire, the Cosmos emulator doesn't work. It does everything as containers. Now you have a bit more control about how the infrastructure is defined. You didn't have that before. So managed identities, for example, there was no way of assigning those. There is now. That's good.
Yeah.
Right? But here's the thing that really bugs me. And after I've said this, I'll come back to where it really works really well and why I'm basically abusing it and getting annoyed with it because I'm using it wrong. The thing that really annoys me is what Aspire should have done, in my opinion, is come along and said, here is a drop-in system that lets you run all this stuff locally, but it doesn't. What you have to do is you can't just use the Cosmos DB client. You have to use the Aspire Cosmos DB client.
Yeah.
You can't just use the Azure SQL client. You have to use the Aspire one, right? And what this means is if you are building an Aspire solution and deploying an Aspire solution, which means everything running on container apps and Aspire managing everything and just basically YOLOing it, really, unless you're deep diving into it to the point where you're basically losing all the benefit of using it, It's just not going to work. Like, you have to use the Aspire. You have to use the Aspire clients. Why? And like, you have to use these Aspire connection strings. Why? Like, I want to deploy it. I want to, you know, build my Azure solution that I architect according to my solution requirements, not according to my Aspire requirements. So what you're doing now is you're bending the solution to the tool and not the other way around. And that is my problem with it fundamentally. Everything else I can tolerate, and everything else is like rough edges. And even that I can tolerate too, because it works well in certain scenarios. But that is the main reason why I am no longer using it as my default on every project, because that's something I can't really justify.
So
now here's where it works well, and here's what it's actually for. And this is why I've, you know, not been using it correctly. Because as I said, it became my default and I was using it for everything, and that shouldn't have been the case. Where it really shines, and it is unparalleled for this, is distributed systems, right? Microservices, if you want to call it microservices, but it's not just microservices. If you are orchestrating a large number of microservices or distributed services, it doesn't just make it easy. It makes it possible in a way locally that was not impossible before, but prohibitive. Like, you know, if you've got all your Docker containers and, you know, you're managing everything yourself, you know, there was ways of doing this before. And what I've discovered is that is the better way for me to do things for not necessarily the smaller projects, but the more monolithic solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Those large scale distributed solutions, it is amazing for those.
Yeah.
And really, that's kind of, if that's not what you're building, it's probably not the right tool for the job. And that's why I've been feeling the pain, is I've just been using it for everything and it's not for that. But getting back to our earlier point, does the messaging around it make that clear? I don't know. And I don't know if that is just a me problem or not.
No, and I think you're onto something there. Like, I remember a while back looking at a Aspire not long after it first came out and still trying to figure out like what is it?
Yeah.
And what really clicked for me back then was, and again, it's not because like, not that there was any marketing around it, because don't forget, like, this was a little pet project for Damien Edwards and David Fowler, right?
Yeah.
That ended up becoming a product.
Yeah.
And like early days, it was basically designed to help with your inner dev loop and manage your local environments whilst you're doing your builds. It was not intended at that point as a publishing platform.
Yeah.
And that's what really got me from the beginning, because when I started looking at it, I was trying to work out how does everything all tie together. And then when you start to actually pull apart and realize, well, it's not there to help in your production environment. It's not there to help get it to production. It's not there to help manage or monitor or run your production environment. It's purely there to help you manage your dev environment.
Yeah.
and to speed up your dev loop and to make sure that make it easy for anyone coming onto the project just to basically hit F5 and have the solution up and running.
Yeah.
And like you said, particularly in a distributed environment where there are multiple dependencies across and multiple different technologies and infrastructure pieces, absolutely.
Yeah.
But this goes to, I think, the point that you're making here is that was version one, and I think it served that small subset, but there's, you know, and myself and I think a few others got confused as to, well, what's the big picture? How does this work for our production environment? How do we get our Aspire application from local dev into production?
Yeah.
And that story was not mature at that point.
Yeah. It's still not, in my opinion. It's a lot more mature than it was, but it still requires you to architect your cloud solution around Aspire and not vice versa.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think like this is...
Whereas if you look at Docker Compose, for example, right?
Yeah.
Docker Compose doesn't... Well, Docker Compose... Like you can use Docker Compose as an orchestrator for deploying your system. Like if you're going to run your system in a container environment, you can have an enterprise quote-unquote Docker Compose file and that's how you deploy it.
Yeah.
But really, that was it never promised to be that. Like if that's what you're using it for, that's on you. But that's never what it promised to be. It promised to be, here's how you can compose your solution locally.
Yeah.
And I think as a replacement for that, and you know where I really kind of first fell in love with Aspire? Do you remember my Beyond Passwords talk that I did a few years ago?
Yeah.
So I had a whole bunch of different things running. I had a bunch of different APIs. I had a UI. I had identity server. And I'd only dabbled really with Docker before then. And I was like, and I remember people saying, Docker's so easy. It just makes everything so easy. All right, I'll go and use Docker. I spent way, way, way more time building the Docker Compose and getting that to work than I did on the actual system itself.
Yeah.
Now, with that said, once I did, it was a fucking game changer because like getting all that shit running without it was a pain. And like, otherwise I've got to deploy it to Azure or I've got to somehow get it all working locally. And it was a real pain. And I did that talk probably four times. So the first time was a struggle. The second time I was like, you know, fuck this. The third time and the fourth time I used the Docker and it paid dividends. Like it was really, really good. So when Aspire came along and I was like, well, that's even better. And if I was doing that talk again, I would use Aspire for it.
Yep.
Because Aspire is amazing for demos and so is AI. And that is my conclusion. And thank you for coming to my TED talk. No, but I mean, like, that's where we're at, I think. It's like, you know, it's like Aspire is amazing for demos and AI is amazing for demos. And there is a lot of potential, but everyone's falling over themselves. No, in fact, again, it's not fair to say this about Aspire, but for AI, 100% true, right? Everyone's falling over themselves to be the next big thing and to not miss the boat on the next big thing. And, you know, if they're not going to be the next big thing, they want to make damn sure the next big thing depends on them.
Yeah.
So everything's just moving too fast and things just aren't working. But that's the world we live in now. And this is what we spoke about over the last couple of episodes. Aspire is a different story because I think Aspire is evolving and is getting better all the time. And I think I am being unfairly critical of it because it's not its version. I would say Aspire is at its version 2 now. It's not at its version 3 yet. And I should stop treating it as such and judging it as such.
No. Well, like I said before, right? It was a pet project.
Yeah.
It was never a product.
Yeah.
And I think once they released it to the public, I mean, even then it wasn't a version 1.
Yeah.
Then the product team in Microsoft said, hey, we can actually turn this into a, like, we're going to throw resources at it.
Yeah.
And so after that, then you get the version 1.
Yeah.
I'd say we're barely at version 2 right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I haven't even been following the updates, but relatively recently, they've added publish to the CLI.
Yeah.
Right. So now, I mean, the simple fact is that it was added late in the game, right?
Yeah.
Which goes to show, back to my point earlier, that it was never a production tool. It was never a publishing tool. It was always a dev, a local dev tool to start first and foremost.
Yeah.
The publish was an afterthought.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's fine, except for the fact that you have to change the way that you do things to make them, you have to quote unquote aspireify them.
Yeah.
And that means that you are now architecting your cloud solution around your local dev experience. And that just feels wrong to me. It's kind of like, and don't shoot me because let me finish, right? But it's kind of like building your code base around your tests. Now, I'm not talking about TDD, that's different, right? But I'm talking about when you write code where you compromise your code and you build escape hatches into your code for your tests to test. And I see it all the time. And it's not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's not that there isn't as well. Like, I reckon
there's an argument to be made there.
Well, of course there is. Yeah.
Like, if you are compromising your code to make it testable,
yeah,
you're doing something wrong.
Yes, that's my point.
You shouldn't be doing that.
Agreed. Yes. I 100% agree with you. That's literally the point I'm making. I think the angle you're coming at it from, though, is that if your code isn't testable without compromising it, then your code is wrong. Whereas I don't necessarily agree with that. I think not all code needs to be directly testable. And I think if you have integration tests that hit your code, they're far more valuable than butchering your code to allow you to unit test it. Because I'll go back to the same thing I've been saying for years. Nobody gives a fuck about your code, right? They give a shit about whether your solution works, and your integration tests are what answer that question.
Yeah. No, I somewhat agree. I'm just trying to unpack how you actually worded that. And I don't know if we've got time here tonight to do that. But no, I do agree, right? Absolutely. I don't think your code quality should be compromised to make it fit, to make it testable.
Yeah.
But if it is not testable, then I think you should take a look at what you're doing, and perhaps there are better ways to do it.
Yeah.
That, I think that's off topic now. So where are we at? Where aren't we at?
I'll tell you where we're at. I think that this conversation has been a good conversation. It's been fun and interesting, but I wouldn't class it as ready for production. Ship it.
So what you're saying is, for the last 2.5 years, we've been selling something that's not fit for consumption. Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm trying to think of a good way of making this an analogy for the homebrewed beer that we make, because we don't sell that. And it is fit for consumption.
It is fit for consumption.
Because we consume it.
And I have been consuming it tonight.
Yeah.
Actually, not all of it is.
No.
No. I mean, like I said, the last two batches, one of them's worked out well. The other one's, I don't know, I think I overboiled it. But it is what it is. I've got to get through it. Yeah. Someone's got to drink it.
Yeah.
It won't get drunk itself.
No. It ain't going to drink itself.
No.
That someone's going to be you, isn't it?
Yep. I don't wish it upon my worst enemies. I guess I have to drink it.
Sounds like you just did.
I have been, yes.
Were you about to say, and on that bombshell?
No.
Okay.
No. I was trying to work out what's the wrap up here.
All right. So we've decided that the beer is fit and safe for consumption, even if it is just by you, but not tonight. Because tonight they have just called last drinks and we are going to have to get on our way. Don't like it?
No, I don't mind it. I'm just trying to figure out where do I pick up on that?
Yeah.
So I guess then, Matt, that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Maybe we can aspire to having a stronger finish for our episode closeouts.
No, I don't mind it. I don't mind it.
But that pun or the episode finish?
The episode finish. The pun is terrible.